So we're here, Mike. Where's here? It's the King's Arms.
The King's Arms.
And it's looking rather splendid, because I've not been here for maybe a couple of months, and it's had a gorgeous makeover inside. It looks absolutely splendid, but also outside has had a makeover as well.
Beautiful, doesn't it? I mean, you blend in with the wallpaper in here. We're in the snug in the King's Arms. So it does blend in with the rather beautiful kind of impressionistic floral print on the wall.
Which is pretty much what I wear all the time.
Which is what he's wearing now. So, yeah, it looks like a big flower.
And it's a bursting hub of activity today, because it's been the Greater Manchester Fringe launch. So every room has been packed, and there's been highlights from some of the Fringe shows being performed upstairs. And we've been desperately grabbing people from packed corridors to get 5 minutes with them on their piece, and also trying to focus a little bit on their process.
Yeah, so we've spoken to... How many people have we spoken to? We've spoken to...
It feels like 200, but it's probably about 20.
But I think we've met some people who are doing some really interesting work, who are kind of covering a wide variety of forms. And I think this year's Fringe is going to be really, really exciting, because I think there's something for everyone from what we, you know, from just the little sample that we've kind of come across today. You're laughing at me.
Well, it's just something for everyone. Such a cheesy phrase.
I know, we've been doing this for quite a long time. We're both exhausted. We've had too many gins.
It's one of the marketing no-nos. When you do marketing training, they say never say that, because it means that there's nothing for anyone.
Oh, right. Well, I don't mean that. I'll edit that out.
I think there are some distinct offerings.
Yeah, there really is.
So there's like definitely a thread I've seen of history plays, people dealing with historical biographical figures or uncovering parts of history that maybe have been misinterpreted and trying to reassess those and present them for a new generation. There's people who are very interested in process and kind of, you know, how they make the work and thinking very carefully and ethically about that. And there's people who are maybe, you know, more traditionally demarked in terms of playwright, actors, scripts, using, you know, reviving really interesting plays but resetting them in northwestern settings. So there's a whole range of work. You're really interested in the puppetry and storytelling through music.
Yeah, so I think there's quite a lot of shows that have been kind of family orientated shows. We just spoke to a company who are making a piece using puppetry and boxes, which sound very interesting. So I think there's a really broad canvas, really.
And thankfully, there isn't a single play by you.
I'm directing one.
Oh, are you? Oh, damn! There's one to endure. I'm sure it's an excellent script, and you'll only damage it a little bit.
We'll limit the damage. But I mean, you're not doing anything, are you? Thankfully.
No. So as a previous winner, I didn't feel like I needed to this year.
Whatever. So we're going to share some of the interviews with the people that we have talked to today, and we will be back all the way through the Fringe, hopefully, with some stuff about Fringe stuff. We have Paul Jenkins with us, and he's performing at the Hope Mill Theatre, which is a beautiful theatre in Manchester.
Wow,
it's one of the kind of newest places. It's an old converted mill, isn't it? It's beautiful, isn't it?
It is, and it's also from looking at its fairy light city during the course of the show, which I love.
You can't go wrong with fairy lights.
You can't go wrong with fairy lights. It makes everything look beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So your show is called My Bottom Did a Burp in Class.
It is. It's an exceptionally serious and very, very, you know, hard hitting piece.
Good.
About bottom burps and about how you suffer from them. Or
and in class. So is this to do with your experiences at school, or are you a teacher?
I used to be a teacher. Out under the fence. I escaped about 5 years ago. I now work as a full-time performance poet, and which is great. I still working in schools all the time. So I get to work with 200 kids at a time doing the odd poems in assembly, and then we'll go in and write new stuff in their classes.
Great.
Now, from that's kind of germinated into this new show. So it's now an hour-long show rather than the quick little snippets that I might do in school. And we write a poem live as part of the show.
Brilliant. And is that...
Does that happen in this show? Or
it does indeed.
Oh, yes. Right, okay. So the audience write a poem?
Yes, we have a waffle bag. Right. We have a bag, quite literally says waffle mix on it, and people put in words as we go through. We draw out words out of the waffle bag. We then have a big whiteboard in the show. The audience can suggest all sorts of things, colours, animals, stuff that they can do, and then we get all that together, and then we write some random piece of poetry, brilliant, usually about badges, skateboarding, and things like that, because all sorts of things come out.
And does the poem just have a life for that night, or does it go on and stay in the show?
I've decided this time, because we've done a few testers of the show to see how it goes, and we've now produced two or three pieces of poetry from those test audiences. And actually, I think it would be quite nice to come, because we've got three dates in Manchester. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of dates up in York, and a little bit of an Edinburgh run, which is great. So I'm going to collect together all of the poems at the end of it and see if we can create some sort of nonsense anthology, which will be quite nice. I don't know quite what life that will have yet, because I don't know what the poems are going to be like. But be interesting to see if any themes develop.
So would you distribute that through the internet, or would you get it published? Or
I self-publish all of my collections. So if it's something that I think has got some sort of worthiness to it, maybe I might put it in book form. But if not, it most definitely would turn up on the website and then Facebook. And it'd be nice, actually, because it maybe to see if we can get some of the audience to maybe narrate some of the poems for like my Facebook page and things. I'm very keen. I've always been a community poet anyway, so getting people to interact with the work is half the job, really.
Yeah,
because then if people are kind of feel a little bit of a connection to it, then they're going to go and tell people about
absolutely
it.
Absolutely. And I suppose it's kind of interactive work almost, isn't it? You know, it's kind of an immersive experience for an audience.
Yeah, I've made a point. One of the first people I worked with was Ian McMillan over in Barnsley, and I've nicked this entirely from him as a way of working, is that he makes sure that he does front of house. He greets people as he comes in the door. Because you don't want to come on the stage and go, oh, I'm the poet, and nobody knows how to behave in that situation. Whereas if you're at the door and you go, oh, I love the bag, look at that, what's going on? Where have you been? Oh, it's raining outside. Everyone's having a chat before you've sat down, and we get to know each other before the show even starts. And that way people feel far more comfortable. When I say, can you name us some animals? They'll shout hippopotamus very loudly from an audience, and it helps.
How often do they say hippopotamus?
Bizarrely, the times we've done it so far, we've had hippo a couple of times. Giraffe has been every single time.
Oh, right.
It's people's go-to imaginary animal. So I'd have gone with badger, personally.
Oh, okay, right.
But, you know,
what would you go for, Stephen?
Oh, I don't know. You're on the spot, aren't you? I was thinking, why do people say giraffe? And I was thinking there's an advert at the moment with giraffes in, isn't there? Where they come in, they put their noses in through the hotel and eat stuff off the plate.
They're very creative animals, giraffes. Yeah. You see it in the wild. They're always drawing pictures and doing, you know, weird dances.
So is all your poetry inspired by stuff that comes out of live performance, or do you have a separate strand where you're off doing your stuff?
Some of it, a lot of my poetry will come from a little bit of equalities and change. We've got a poem called Sir Fabulous, who is a non-typical knight. He's a knight that rides a rainbow unicorn and he's covered in glitter from head to foot.
Right.
We've got a fairy, but she's not a fairy. She's a rock fairy. You know, she's dressed all in black with her hair in a bun. The rock fairy rarely goes out in the sun. It's all those sorts of characters. One that you would expect to see in a certain light, but actually we turn them on their head quite a bit.
Great.
And the rest of it is just nonsense and mostly about flatulence. There's one called Zupu, which the entirety of the reason that I wrote Zupu was because it's apparently a really good rhyme if you rhyme species with feces. So the two come together and it's developed into a poem.
So you said that Ian McMillan, did you say?
Yeah.
So he's your kind of, would you say he's an influence? Or
definitely. Yeah. I worked at my first foray into poetry when I left teaching was on a something called Picture the Poet, and Ian was leading the school's workshops and I was the school's facilitator alongside that, so I got to work really closely with him over a period of about 18 months. And he was just very, very supportive of me, you know, getting out, producing work. He came up to Ramsbottom and I had the honour of supporting him and Tony Husband with their cartoon, The History of Here show. It's just been a fantastic person to be around poetry-wise. And to never say, you know what, no, don't do that, do it this way. He's always said, well, try it, give it a go, see what flows.
And who, when you get a kind of a little kernel of an idea, how do you develop that? Did you just sit down and just write it down, or do you just let it kind of fester in your head for a while? What's your process?
Essentially, the technique we use in the show is called splurging, or I've called it splurging. Mm. And it's the idea is you just capture every single idea that you've got, write it down, because then it can't escape. And it's not, it's essentially a big, massive whiteboard with words in every single direction, even the worst ideas, because then you can pick out the little cherries that you want and you can reassemble them together. You know, if somebody gives you 12 animals, well, actually, and 12 colours and 12 activities, that's when you get purple giraffes bicycling. You think, okay, right, why are purple giraffes bicycling? What's going on there? Yeah. And why are they purple? Are they alien giraffes? What's happening there? And you start asking questions back to yourself.
Great.
That's how it develops.
Oh, okay, that's really interesting, because I work fairly similarly to that myself, actually. Mm. But great, you had a question.
No, just was wanting to make sure we got the dates in for when you're at Hope Mill.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the 22nd, 23rd and 24th at 1 p.m. The show goes on during that time, and from that as well, we'll also be selling copies of the book. So there's three books that are attached to the show. It's My Bottom Dinner Burping Class, Wibbly Wobbly Words, and The Man in the Silly Hat. And for those of you watching at home on this podcast, I am currently wearing the silly hat right now.
You are, actually, yes.
It's a black bowler with a green trim. Nobody would wear it in public.
So it's a brilliant lunchtime treat.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
So it says big kids and little kids. So presumably this is a kind of a family show, and it's...
This is very much... I mean, I've just said to the audience upstairs, which are majority adult performers, there's you know, young people are not obligatory at this show, and if you fancy coming along, it's actually just a very light-hearted route through the afternoon, which it will also be more than suitable for children. I think the more we kind of do children's theatre and kind of look down to children and say, oh, you've got to have this type of story, actually they've got the same sense of humour we have. It's just that, you know, we obviously need to kind of tailor
it. It's better than ours, isn't it?
Oh,
better
than
yours.
Yeah.
I mean, if you talk to any primary school teacher across the land, your children have very, very quick wits, and they've got faster brains than any of us. So my job is to try and keep up with them, not the other way around.
Brilliant.
So My Bottom Did a Burp in Class, Monday the 22nd, Tuesday 23rd, Wednesday the 24th, 1 p.m. at the Hope Mill Theatre in Manchester. £8 big kids, £6 little kids. Little kids, I can't say it. Little kids. We have Miranda Parker with us, who's the director of Our Kid, which is Northern Nights production. That's at the King's Arms on the 18th. The 24th, the 27th and the 31st of July at 4 p.m, 7 p.m and 7:30 p.m. I guess just go to the website and
find it. Slightly complicated.
Yeah. So
just remember
it's
Our Kid.
At some point.
Yeah. So it's called Our Kid. So you're the director, and Taryn Knight
is the writer and the performer.
Yeah.
So he's the actor. It's all his baby, really.
Have you worked with him during script development, or have you come in with a finished script?
No, he's come in with a finished script, and we read it through a few times, and we changed some of the sort of the way the thread of the story works a little bit. It's mainly what it was originally there on the stage, but some of the timelines didn't quite make sense, really, so we've tried to make sure it's a little bit swifter, a bit slicker and more believable,
So Taryn actually came along to the Greater Manchester Fringe Right to the Stage development conference, and he came and did the workshop with Rob Ward.
Oh, right.
And so so that was part of... So he was writing this then, so it'll be really exciting to see.
Because I think he spent some time with Jim Cartwright trying to get it up off its feet, and then he's gone a bit further with it. So, and now he's taken a big step. I think it's a big step for Taryn trying to do this. It's a big deal, isn't it, a one-man show?
You've
got everything at risk, haven't you?
Absolutely.
There's no one to help you out.
No one to hide.
You're just there. If it goes wrong, it's only you. You can't blame anyone else.
But he's, I suppose, because he's written it, he's kind of... So your role has been to kind of be the outside eye, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I've known Taryn for a few years. I'm a teacher by trade. I work at the Oldham College, teaching performing arts. I've been there for 10 years. And Taryn came to do some teacher training with me about 4 or 5 years ago. And then he got back in touch to sort of say, I do a lot of JB Shorts. I've done about 10 JB Shorts over the years, and a few bits and pieces around Manchester. But it's the first time being part of the Greater Manchester Fringe, so it's quite exciting for me. Yeah. I've never done anything like this before, so it's all new.
So what attracted you to the Fringe? What feels kind of...
It was an opportunity to say yes. You know, you spend so much time, don't you, in a bubble of life, and then somebody gives you an opportunity, and you need to take things and say yes, I'd like to do this.
Yeah.
So it was a good opportunity for me to try and get more known as a director. Like I said, I've done JB for the past 9 years, so I've done lots and lots of JB shorts, So I'm quite happy in that 15 minute medium.
yeah.
But then to actually do, you know, it's going to be a good 50 minute an hour play. So yeah. That'd be quite interesting for me as well.
And one, I mean, a one man show is a challenge as well as a director, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because,
yeah.
You know, you've got to help that the storytelling.
Yeah.
And that sense of being able to conjure everything and everybody through
absolutely.
One performance.
Yeah. And try to make it as exciting as it possibly can be, so it doesn't drop. I think with you've got an hour of somebody on stage, it can get, you know, you don't want the audience to switch off, so it's really, it is my job to make sure that they don't.
Just keep it, like, keep the pace going.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've got to pull out every trick out.
And also, he's playing all the characters in the show as well. So he plays his mother, his grandma, Dave, who's his friend.
So it's making all each of those characters differentiable, isn't it?
Yeah, making them should come to life on the page, really. Yeah, right. In front of people.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much. So it's Our Kid at the King's Arms, a variety of dates between the 18th and the 31st of July. So come along and see it. We have Anna Girolami with us, who's written a piece called Once Upon a Time in Trieste, which is being performed at Hope Aria House on the 10th of July at 1 p.m. and 11th and 12th of July at 7 p.m. So, Anna, just tell us a little bit about the show, just to start off with.
Once Upon a Time in Trieste is a two-hander. It's about 75 minutes long. And basically, our hero is a man who was supposed to assassinate Mussolini, attempted to do so, and the rest of the play is him trying to come to terms with the actions. I can try not to give any spoilers.
Great, okay. So it's a history-based play.
Mussolini, one knows what happened to him.
Yeah. So this is an imagined alternate reality or something you've researched to create the story?
It's very much a mix of both.
Right.
That was very much a nutshell. There's quite a lot more to it. The poor man gets trapped in a castle in Trieste, a real castle in Trieste, with a princess who lived about 70 years before he did. She's real. She's a real cat, a real person, historical person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She actually existed. She actually lived in that castle. He's totally fictional. I've made him up.
Right.
So he's in 1938. She's 1967. They're both going mad. They're both trapped in this castle.
And the play allows us to fold those two time streams together, so they can meet each other.
Yes.
Yeah, wonderful. And where did that come from in your imagination?
Trieste is quite personal to me, although I've lived in England all my life. My father's family are from the region of which Trieste is the capital.
Right.
So Trieste itself has always fascinated me. It has a particularly convoluted and fascinating history. So I wanted to explore some of that. I also read a lot of spy fiction, far too much, the way I could. And I got very interested with the idea of overlap, either geographical overlap or temporal overlap, of two people in the same place or two people in the same time, both having utterly different lives.
Mm.
Now, I'm not a particularly experienced playwright, so to explore two different places on a stage, for me, was quite a difficult call. But I can explore the same place at two different times.
Yeah.
So I started with that.
Lovely. Why this princess in particular? Why did she stand out?
Just because she's a very interesting, she's got a very useful story to me. I kind of wanted to set it in Mussolini's time. That's kind of where I started.
Mm-hmm.
So there was my hero. And I needed another time and another character to put up against him. So once you start researching Trieste, which was a Habsburg seaport in the, for several hundred years,
mm-hmm.
At that point, you start to come across with the members of the royal family, Franz Joseph, Maximilian, and Charlotte, Princess Charlotte, is pointing, absolutely no use at all, is it?
No. Well, there is a lovely picture of Princess Charlotte in the Greater Manchester Fringe Brochure, which you will be able to pick up when you come and see one of the lovely shows.
Princess Charlotte, who's a real person, she lived, among other places, in Trieste in 1860. She was Empress of Mexico, which I had no idea about.
Wow, I've never even heard that title.
Exactly.
Empress of Mexico.
Maximilian was Emperor of Mexico.
Right.
Genuinely, she was Empress of Mexico. Genuinely, all went horribly wrong, and she came back to Trieste and went quietly mad. So,
so you caught her at that stage of her life.
That's a very rich life, one imagine.
It's a really rich life, isn't it? So, from my point of view, as something to put up against this poor revolutionary who's trying to kill Mussolini, it was just brilliant.
Yeah, lovely.
It was a bit of a mind, but it was brilliant.
And a great clash of of different times, different cultures, worlds, different values, different language, all of that to play with.
There's at least three different languages in the play.
Oh right, yeah. Because I've had a look at the first couple of pages. Yeah,
so the rest of it's English. It's all right.
Yeah. So, but yeah, there is some kind of language that I didn't understand. Yeah, yeah, great. But that's so. How do you? So, are you planning to have it in? You know, perform it in those different languages, and how do you kind of expect the audience to respond to theatre in different languages?
There's only literally a few sentences. There's like one sentence in Italian, one in French.
Oh, right, okay. So
the rest of it's in English. And I'm simply not capable of writing a play in French.
Right.
I like the fact you didn't even recognise French or Italian on the page.
Well, I've looked at it ages ago. I can't.
It's a while ago.
What a number
two. Oh, God, you're so lovely. Okay, so wonderful. So are you performing in it? Or
no,
you've
got no.
So who are you? Yes. So are you directing it? Or?
I have a wonderful director called Simon Corbell, who has a history with Manchester already. It's a few years, but he does. And he has assembled, we've got Sarah Gordon, who's a Buxton, and I live in Buxton, Sarah Gordon lives in Buxton, Simon lives near Buxton. So she's Princess Charlotte, and her nephew Carl, who lives very near here, I believe, he's working today, unfortunately, is Pinko, is the hero.
Right, wonderful.
Yes.
And just tell us the date and the name of the play and where it's going to be.
Certainly, Once Upon a Time in Trieste will be at Hope Aria Academy, Wednesday the 10th of July at 1 p.m, Thursday the 11th of July,
7 p.m. Yes.
That's right, and Friday, I've lost track now, is that the 13th or 14th of... No, it's not.
We'll edit this bit out, don't worry. So.
It's all in the brochure.
I said it in the beginning.
One more free plug?
Of course, yeah.
Because this is a play about a Slovene hero, who's Slovenian, our hero, and the Slovene community in Britain is quite small, I believe. So, trying to think who might be interested in coming to see this play, I contacted some Slovene groups. And we have somebody attending on a Thursday evening from the Slovenian Embassy in London.
Oh, wonderful.
A diplomat is coming up from London.
Wow.
I know, I'm just so impressed with
red carpet time.
Exactly, yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, that's exciting. So bringing people from outside of Manchester to the Manchester Fringe.
Absolutely.
Brilliant.
That's your time to invite someone from the British Council.
Oh, what's the British Council?
The British Council is something that funds British cultural endeavour overseas and gives it an international audience.
Right.
So knowing that you've got somebody from the embassy attending is a good lever to invite them.
Right, I shall look into that. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
He knows all about this.
Yeah, I just don't. I really don't.
But that's why we do it. That's why that's what's great about it. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
So we have Megan, Melissa, George and Cameron from Broken Glass Productions, so welcome.
Yes.
And they've got a show called Is Trying Enough, and it's on at The Empty Space. Tell me about The Empty Space. I don't know much about The Empty Space. What's the...
It was formerly called the Footlight House Theatre.
Oh, okay, right. So
it's in Media City.
Yeah.
You guys meant to visit it.
Yeah. It seemed quite like an interesting space. So it's a black box theatre. And it's in like a bit of an industrial estate, and it was built about 2.5 years ago, I think. And when we went there, she showed us around everything, and she showed us a picture of when it was just like an empty space, I suppose. So yeah, about 2.5 years, it's become like a black box theatre with a bar, and I think that's like regular.
Brilliant. So that's really close to Media City as well, isn't it? So you know, get people from BBC to come and see it. That'd be always be nice. And ITV's there as well, isn't it? Okay, great. So so who wrote the show?
Melissa.
Okay, great. So Melissa, tell us a little bit about how you kind of got the initial idea and how it's got to this stage.
Yeah, okay. So I was just listening to music on a bus, and then this scene literally popped into my head, and then from that scene, like these characters before, like I've seen the characters almost, and basically it sort of just writes itself in a way. Like,
okay, great. You had an epiphany.
It sounds a bit like that, yeah. But it was just, and I just wanted people to see these characters like so much, like, because I think a lot of people can relate to some aspects of the whole play itself.
So what's the themes of the play? What's it about?
So the themes are, so it's three siblings who had quite a tough upbringing, not much money, lived in a council flat. The play starts as Jay comes out of prison, and he hasn't seen his other two siblings for like and from that how they're building the relationship back up and stuff like that, and the guiltiness of leaving the family and getting locked up.
And so things have changed. So things have changed, and you're coming back, and you kind of expect everything to be the same or whatever.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Oh right. Okay. Great. So, how far along the process were you in getting the script together before you got your cast together?
It was 3 years.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you've been working on this for a while, yeah.
So, it was. I just didn't put it out there, basically, and when it came to the fact. Safe area to establish this
festival. So Lipa is the Liverpool Institute of Performing Arts?
Yes.
And is that where you all met?
Yes.
Are you all there currently?
Yes.
Right. So what course are you doing?
Applied Theatre.
Oh, right, wonderful. Yeah. So that's really close to the Everyman, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful theatre, isn't it?
Liverpool is such a good city
theatre. It's great theatre.
There's so much going on.
Yeah. So why did you come to Manchester? Not that sounds really weird, didn't it?
Now Mancunians all hate you.
Because you know Liverpool is great for theatre, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, as is Manchester. So why have you thought of bringing it to Manchester?
To get a wider audience. And I think Manchester art-wise is amazing. It's so diverse, and there's loads of different artists and performers, and it's really good to try and get into that network.
Brilliant. I think it's really brilliant that you brought it over as well, because one of the puzzles to me is that you've got loads going on in Liverpool, loads going on in Manchester, lots of it's really great, but cross-pollinating between the two cities doesn't really happen.
It doesn't very much, no.
I think we're speaking about this in the way, we've been in Liverpool now for 2 years, and we're quite comfortable, I'm from Manchester myself, so I'm comfortable in Manchester, but I mean, as a company, we're very comfortable in Liverpool now, and we know where we want to go in Liverpool and what theatres we might be able to perform in and what audience we'll attract, whereas Manchester's a new space for us as a group.
Great, well done for bringing it. So have you put stuff on in Liverpool already?
Yeah.
Have you got kind of done trial runs of this? Or
yes,
yeah. Trial runs. So where did you do that?
In Liverpool itself.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah, because they have three theatres inside the building. So we put it on there, and we really expect it because it is literally a work in progress.
Mm.
And basically, it got a lot of great
fantastic response that we weren't expecting. We started off with just the one night, and our university headmaster came to see the show. And originally
called them principals, I think.
Headmaster, I like that.
So originally it was just the one show, and it was just closed to the students of the university, and he came to see it, and then he got changed over to a public show later in that day. And both the shows we had really good turnout. And then following on from that, we got brought in for a meeting with him, and it was from there that we kind of had the inspiration to bring it over here and make a public show and do it on our own.
So you've got some real momentum behind the show. Now, it's on. I think we've got one day to get it. Is that right?
Oh, wow.
8th of July, but there are two performances.
Yes.
3 and 7:30. Yeah. So an afternoon or an evening, 8th of July.
What day of the week is the 8th?
A Monday.
Right, okay, great. Yeah, absolutely. Because I think the Fringe, traditionally Mondays are always difficult days to get people to go out. But throughout the Fringe, people are out anyway. So
So
lovely.
Brilliant. Okay, well, all the best for it. I nearly said the terrible...
No.
Break a leg. But hopefully we'll look forward to it. Have you put it in for the stage price for new writing?
We'll do that, yeah.
Good, great, great.
We'll do that.
All right, wonderful. We have Bev Green and Andrew C. Husband, who's here to talk about 50 and Nifty, which is on at the King's Arms on the 6th at midday, and Miners Arts Centre. Well, that's an interesting place. We'll have to talk about that. 14th and the 27th at 6 p.m. So this is five short pieces, and they kind of interlink, do they?
They do all sort of interlink. So you've got, it's under the umbrella of age and age discrimination. There's comedy.
Hence
so
the name, 50 and Nifty.
We just sort of wanted to highlight the fact that a lot of people do sort of get written off. There's been an actor in that, a lot of the briefs are 18 to 25. So, it's harder when you get older, and I'm finding that the older I get.
She looks very youthful, though.
I know, I can't believe it. Incredible. Both of you,
I
can't believe you're on this topic.
I've got 1 year to go until I get to the big 50. I'm in the last year, so it's my birthday next week, and then 49 next week. Yeah, so So yeah, I together with Andrew, I have a company called 1180 Productions.
And that's the production company that's doing this, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah. Basically, I want to get new writing out there and hopefully give a platform, not just to myself, hence why, you know, I've got Andrew on board, to other people, to new writers, to actors and stuff that, you know, that need a platform, you know, because it is a difficult business.
With a focus on people 50 and over? Or?
No, this particular generally. One is. So this one is, I sort of like to have another show I did a while ago had a theme, so I like a common theme under them all, if you know what I mean, but really just all about trying to get unknown actors and unknown writers out there and get the stuff produced and you know.
So Andrew, tell us a little bit about your piece then.
Mine, it's sort of had a transformation because originally it was going to be it's a father and son. The father lives in a care home, and it was originally based on my own father and his experience of dementia and everything. But Act One was complete, and it was a play in its own right, happily minding its own business till the writer got a phone call from a person sat very close to me saying, "Have you thought of writing Act Two?" Which then actually I wrote it within 24 hours, which was amazing, really.
Bubbling away in your subconscious.
So anyway, because long story short, I wrote it, and then when we started rehearsing, the director we've got on board, Anthea Carpenter Proctor, actually pointed out that the dementia side of it wasn't working. And I agreed, because of the action in Act Two, it made the dementia references in Act One, it didn't quite work, because Act Two actually is actually 12 months after Act One. So
we see the development of the...
The development and everything. And with dementia, as I know from experience, it goes down, it doesn't go up.
Yeah.
You know, consciously.
Yeah.
I really needed the character to be aware of what's going on and to be able to defend himself.
Yeah.
Because he's accused of something in that too that causes a lot of trouble. There's been trouble between him and his son, who have an uneasy relationship at the best of times, but. This has been a devastating blow for the son and for the father when he finds out about it.
So is this the first piece that you've written, or have you been writing for a long time?
I've written before. I did actually have one perform last year.
At the Fringe?
Not quite the Fringe. It was with Anna from Alden.
Once Upon a Time in Trest, right?
Yeah, I did one called... I forgot what it's called now. It was actually a story about three young boys and their dynamics.
Yeah.
So we've got two young gay lads, and then a third one comes along and disrupts the ether. So that was my first play, and it was actually ended up getting published.
Great,
rather nice. So, this is only the second thing I've written that I've actually let anybody read.
Right, brilliant. Okay, great. So, Bev, you were saying that you applied for the Carolina Hearn Prize, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Well, since it came out, I applied the first year and I made it into the last 20%, which was
amazing. Yeah,
it's really good.
So this last year, 2018, I thought, right, okay, I'm going to go again. So I tidied everything up a little bit and sent it off. And then I got an email saying that I'd got to the last 20 people.
So was that shortlist time?
Time, yeah. And then the next day, because they're still getting over that, and then the next day gets a call from the BBC, I'm now a finalist. I'm going to go to London to meet with the head of comedy, and it was all that.
Wow.
So I did went along, met with them, and I had a great interview, and I didn't win it. They emailed me back a couple of days after and said, you know, did really well, Bob, and I finished in the top four.
Which is amazing. That is brilliant. Absolutely.
Yeah. I am really pleased. And I didn't come out of the interview thinking, oh, I wish I'd said this, I wish I'd said that. Yeah. I come out thinking, do you know what? That's me, take it or leave it.
Those interviews are difficult, aren't they? Because you never know what to say.
No, that's it. And it was very relaxed. It wasn't a formal interview and that, but it was still extremely. Go to that big building in London, stressful. You know, all little alone. So it was an absolutely fantastic experience. Yeah. You know? And one of the things that came out of it, you know, they give me so much feedback on my work, on the writing, and you have to send a video of yourself performing as well. So I got a real load of feedback, which is great. And one of the things that they said was that the reason they didn't choose me was because I didn't have enough stuff under my belt. So hence why I'm at the fringe.
Great.
Putting some stuff
doing,
under my belt.
And doing it. Yeah. Going out there and doing it.
And the other four pieces?
So basically, it's an evening of five plays, but they all follow on. So 50 and Nifty is, again, like the age thing umbrella, but it's also a meeting for the over 50s.
Right.
So Marjorie Pardo, who is the leader of 50 and Nifty, runs this group to help people. She doesn't help people, she's absolutely vile. And she just, like, ruins people's
lives. You'll be able to relate to that.
Yeah, she even makes poor Andrew here, who plays Edward, take his wig off. Which is it's just take it off.
Stephen is clutching his head at the moment as she says.
She's the most vile woman you've ever met in your life. But anyway, so
well, I think that's just worth coming to see just for that.
Exactly. Instead of promoting what 50 and Nifty is about, then it should be a group for over 50s to dance and do all this stuff. It's like, no, over 50, you just sit down, you don't do anything. All we talk about are funeral plans and things like that. You know.
It's like watching ITV 3 in the daytime.
So each week, so you've got, and essentially the night will be, Marjorie will come on and you'll be at week one on a Thursday evening at 50 and Nifty. And then we'll go off, Andrew's play will come on, and you'll be in the first year of Andrew's play. Then the next play is mine, which is next Thursday. You've come, oh, nice to see you again, thank you for coming, you know, nice to see you back. Then we're at the second meeting, then Andrew's play is a year later, and then the last meeting is the week after. So it's like 3 weeks meetings with Andrew's play in between.
Okay, well, I think it sounds great. Yeah. So King's Arms, 6th of July, which is a Friday.
Saturday.
So Saturday at midday. So that's a good time, actually, because people really like matinees, actually. Yeah. So that's really good. And then the Miners Arts Theatre.
Is that in Moston?
Moston.
Yeah, I've been there, I think.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah. That's the 14th and 27th at 6 p.m. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Yeah. Break a leg, and we'll come and see you. Thanks for listening to the Right for the Stage podcast in conjunction with the Greater Manchester Fringe Festival. We'll be back with more previews and interviews discussing creative processes tomorrow. Before you go, take a quick listen to Jonathan Hall, last year's winner of the Right for the Stage Prize for New Writing. He talks about how winning the prize has helped progress his career.
Winning the award last year gave me a massive boost of confidence in myself as a writer. To the extent I've started getting paid writing work, I'm writing a novel that was accepted on a sort of a fast track publication scheme, and I've got a play in with BBC Radio 4, possibly a trilogy, and I can mark it all back to winning that award. So it was a massive big deal for me, so thank you.